Okay, thank you, Sri. Well, following your advice, I took out about half the charts, so we'll have plenty of time for discussion. Maybe I'll move this over here. So I'll be seminaring here for 2 days, and I'm going to start out by talking about high redshift bursts and afterglows today. And tomorrow I'll talk about our results on short bursts and also on supernova. We do not just... Hi, Elena. All right. Not just burst astronomy, but we do all kinds of different things. We have three instruments on board. It's an exciting time the last week. We hardly had any bursts in December, statistical fluctuation, and then we just went blazing through January with about 10 bursts in a row. And last night and the day before, there were two very long bursts. I start out by showing this one from yesterday. This is actually one of the most remarkable bursts we've had the whole mission. These aren't seconds here. This is the gamma ray light curve. These are minutes. This thing lasted for more than 10 minutes. And we triggered on this tiny, you can't even see it on this plot, a tiny little precursor back there at 55 minutes. And that was a good thing. As I'll show you in a minute, SWIFT slews the X-ray and optical telescopes on board to point it wherever there's a burst. And so we got there with the X-ray and optical telescope just before the huge burst occurred. So this is the first time with the focusing sensitive instruments that we really caught a burst right down the pipe. And this is amazing. You know, this is what normally you'd call the afterglow, but it's not the afterglow. We actually caught the main part of the burst. These two peaks here are the main peak here. And then it starts going into afterglow. But start out just quickly telling you so you're familiar. I think most of you already know what the instruments are, but we have a wide field gamma ray telescope, the burst alert telescope, looks at two-star radian field of view. It positions burst to a couple of arc minutes. And then the spacecraft slews to that position within a minute, and we look with the X-ray telescope and the UV optical telescope. We also send the data right back down, you know, down to the ground quickly so ground-based observers can look. The strengths of the mission is that we have a very sensitive BAT instrument. It's the most sensitive burst telescope that's ever been built. It also has really sophisticated trigger software that was developed at Los Alamos by Ed Fenimore and David Palmer. And so we're able to trigger on, you know, quite a variety of bursts. And then probably the main thing is, in a way, it's an afterglow observatory, you know, with this slewing and these sensitive narrow field instruments. You can see here that with SWIFT, we get on the burst right after it occurred when the afterglow is really bright instead of hours later, you know, which is kind of typical, at least of the Beppo-Sachs era. And that's what the observatory looked like in Florida before we launched it. And we launched a little more than a year ago, a beautiful launch. So we've been up, we turned on the instruments in December and January, so it's been about 1 year now. So I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about the statistics, and then we'll turn to the high redshift burst. So delighted to say all the instruments are performing well. We are detecting about 100 per year, gotten up to 108 now. BATS, more sensitive than BATSY. Of course, with BATSY, you weren't able to position bursts very accurately. It's quite a bit more sensitive than HETI and Beppo-Sachs. And the XRT is also more sensitive, not than Chandra, but than, you know, the typical kind of X-ray telescopes like on Beppo-Sachs that we're following up before. We get a flow of images that come out from the observatory, positioning bursts to a couple of arc minutes at first, then 6 arc seconds within a minute, and all these go out as notices on the GCN. And then if we have an optical detection on board, we get it to better than an arc second. So it's pretty capable. Can't follow up every burst because sometimes there's the moon or the sun is, you know, the constraints. But we follow up almost all of them. We've slewed, for these 108 bursts, we slewed to 93 of them. And 85 of those 93 had X-ray detections. The few that didn't were mostly ones where we slewed rapidly and then didn't, you know, where we didn't slew rapidly, we got on a few minutes later or even an hour later. For those that we slewed rapidly, there are two cases when we didn't see X-ray emission, and I'll be talking about those tomorrow. those were both short bursts. So for the long burst, every time we've slewed, we've seen X-ray emission. And as was known before the mission, about half the bursts are dark. That continues on now. If you add up our onboard telescope plus the ground-based telescopes, there are about 50 that are seen, 50 out of the 100 that are seen in the optical. We have 27 redshifts. Okay, so we'll turn to this September 04 burst. It was really a remarkable burst. This is the one that was at a redshift of 6.3. So the photons for this, the gamma ray photons that were born 12.8 billion years ago, they've been traveling to us since when stars were first forming through the peak of star formation. They penetrated through the outskirts of several galaxies on the way, and finally, dropped dead exhausted in our CZT detectors. And as they came to us, the universe expanded. And so this is what the light curve looked like. This is what it looked like in the rest frame of the burst. So it was time dilated by a factor of 1 plus z, so 7.3. It was very broad. It was actually hard to trigger on this burst. I mentioned this capable trigger algorithm that was developed at Los Alamos. Not only does it look for rate triggers, but it also compares images to make sure that something didn't very slowly rise and appear that way. And so this burst didn't have a rate trigger, but it had an image trigger, and that allowed us to get it. The X-ray afterglow was quite surprising. I'm going to show you lots of cases where we're seeing flares, so you may think that that's typical. But a typical afterglow is more like a monotonic decay, maybe with some changes in slopes. Now, I'll show you some of those too later. But this one wasn't anything like that. Now, look at these huge flares continuing not in the first, not just the first hundreds of seconds, but out to more than a day. Tremendously bright flares that were occurring. Wanted to point out that this afterglow emission, because we'll be talking about what you can do with high redshift bursts and why is it interesting to study them, was so much brighter than any kind of high redshift X-ray source that we know of. This is the level times 100, so it's 100 times higher, of one of the brightest hard X-ray high redshift sources. And you can see that we're orders of magnitude greater than this. In fact, at the beginning of this afterglow, the X-ray flux was about a tenth that of the Crab from this object that was coming, from the edge of the universe. So it's amazing. And that's the power of bursts for studying the early universe, that they, at least for a period of time, a day or so, they are extremely bright, more luminous than anything else in the universe. These flares are kind of, I wouldn't say typical, but there are three cases out of about sort of five or six of our high redshift bursts greater than four. About half of the time, you see these very bright flares, much more flaring, at least with our small statistics that we have, than is typical for lower redshift bursts. There isn't enough evidence yet to really make a strong case about this, but there's a hint at least that there's perhaps lower metallicity or something going on at high redshift that causes this flaring. The story of how this came to be known as a high redshift burst, how it was found that it was high redshift, is kind of interesting. I'll just tell you the short version. But basically, Dan Reichert, who was a graduate student at Don Labs, he's been interested in high redshift bursts all along, built a telescope, a specialized telescope in Chile called SOAR, that does photometry in multiple bands simultaneously. It's basically four telescopes all co-aligned. And one of the first bursts that he looked at was this one, and he noticed, these aren't his data, these are VLT data, but his were the same, that there was almost no optical emission, and yet it was fairly bright in the infrared. So that was the first hint, and all the first circulars were coming from this broadband photometry showing that it was very likely was at high redshift. And then there was this beautiful spectrum that was obtained by the Subaru telescope, Mauna Kea. And, here's the Lyman Alpha break, redshifted all the way up into the far red. So you know, from the attic down into the basement. And there's beautiful lines that are seen, and so we're able to get a redshift of 6.3 very accurately. And like the X-rays, it's also quite bright. With 17th magnitude at 3.5 hours, this object was probably 14th magnitude right after it happened. We don't know, but you know, it was very bright early on. Lam and Sakamoto have made this nice plot. This is the flux for a burst and the fluence. And each of these faint lines here shows different bursts that we've seen with SWIFT. So it sort of shows you where you need to be to have a burst that will be detected. It needs to have a bright enough flux to be trigger. It needs to have enough fluence to give enough counts. And these are the high redshift bursts right here, shown by the red dots. And as they would move to higher redshift, they would follow these red tracks. There are a couple of them shown here. And so this burst, 6.3, we could have seen it out to maybe a redshift of 8 or 9. But this bright one, this wasn't even a SWIFT burst. This was before launch, 2000 January 31, could have been seen all the way out to a redshift of 20. So there will be some very bright, very high redshift bursts that we see with SWIFT. And this is these are the things that you can do. And then in the following view graphs, I'll be showing you where we're starting to do each of these different areas. This is just a few months old, this whole study of very high redshift bursts. But certainly, since long bursts are caused by the core collapse of massive stars, we'll be able to study when stars were born, when the first stars occurred, you know, if they're population 3 stars, and look at the star formation history in an independent way from other techniques. First light and reionization of the IGM. There's already nice work on the metallicity history of the universe, and even cosmology. I have a couple of preliminary things in that area to show you. So this is beautiful work that done in Shree's group. Ido Berger published this. And it's a burst, 050505, at a redshift of 4.3. And basically, it's a damped Lyman alpha study. Bursts are very powerful tools for doing damped Lyman alpha techniques. Usually, this is done with quasars, or previously it was done with quasars. Quasar light is coming to us. It goes through dense neutral clouds, and you can look at the lines, the Lyman alpha, the damped Lyman alpha line in particular, and all these other lines about the clouds. The nice thing with bursts is, first of all, they're bright. I've already mentioned that. Second of all, they're embedded in the cloud that you want to study. There's an impact parameter issue, it's one of the aspects of quasar studies that you have different impact parameters. But for bursts, you have this bright source right in the middle of the cloud. And there's a lot you can do carbon and silicon and different lines. And for this burst here, the different parameters that Berger and Al all determined. First of all, the column depth is 10 to the 22. It's a factor of 10 to 100 greater than the typical column depth that's seen with the quasar DLA work. You can derive what the density of the medium and the size is. At least you can make estimates of that. It's about 100 per cubic centimeter. Quite a low metallicity from this object at 4.3. You can even guess what the progenitor was like. In this case, just by looking at the velocity, the line shape of shape, you can get velocity and make an estimate of the progenitor, and it seemed to be less than 25 solar masses. This is a little bit of a surprise. A year ago, we were talking about gamma ray bursts due to 40 solar mass, really massive stars, but already there's other indications that you know, maybe this number is coming down. For this burst and for others, in this same paper, Ito plots the metallicity versus redshift. Now, the faint lines are what are done with the QSO DLA studies, and then these are done with the bursts. And the metallicity, first of all, it shows a trend, of course, lower metallicity towards higher redshift, but the metallicity is systematically higher. What's the explanation? Probably because you're buried in these clouds where stars are forming. there tends to be more metallicity there than on average in the galaxies. So it's a very complementary technique to the quasar work.
Just a quick question on that. Progenitor mass, that's the mass of the progenitor at collapse?
At collapse.
Okay, so that really isn't a strong constraint on the... I mean, that could be a much larger... When we talk about 40 solar mass star, we're talking about ZAM's mass.
Yeah. So, well, I don't know. Maybe Sri can comment.
Well, this is based on the mass loss thing. I mean, you know, this will change. I'm not... I wouldn't want to say anything that this would be such a problem.
But you were saying 25 at collapse. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, talking about metallicity, I was going to show you this beautiful plot that Andy Fruchter has made. So these aren't Swift images. These are images of HST of pre-Swift bursts. And he's looked at about 30 different bursts and gotten beautiful HST images. And what he finds is that the bursts, they trace the brightest region in the host, even more concentrated than type 2 supernovae. There's very few that are in grand, what he calls grand design, you know, large spiral galaxies. This is one case out of 20 only. And the hosts tend to be subluminous, irregular galaxies. There have been indications of this by previous studies, but this is probably the best study that really shows that. So the conclusion is that bursts tend to be concentrated in regions of the most massive stars and restricted to low metallicity galaxies. Maybe restricted is too strong a word, but there's a hint that they're coming from low metallicity dwarf galaxies. So low metallicity may be an important factor in determining what stars make gamma ray bursts. I wanted to show you a little bit, getting back to Swift data here, what our redshift distribution is compared to prior to Swift and what we're learning about star formation rates from that. It's a surprise to me anyway, the high redshift average that Swift is producing, at least at first, but now it seems to make a lot of sense. The Swift average is 2.5. Prior to Swift, the average was about 1. So the whole time I've been working in bursts for 15 years, actually, it's just since 97 with the Beppo-Sachs results. We've been talking about redshift typical of 1. But really, I think the real number is more like an average redshift of 2. The previous samples were not complete. Swift is more sensitive. I think we're seeing more of the true average of bursts. And it's a very high redshift. But it's not a surprisingly high number. The star formation history of the universe, the star formation peaks at a redshift of 2 to 3. And in fact, here's a nice work that Jacobson and all have done. And this is comparing, this is the cumulative distribution of bursts. And you can see the pre-Swift bursts in blue here. Here the Swift bursts shown in red. And then it's fitted to different models where star formation is where bursts are proportional to star formation. And these are different lines for different star formation models. But you can see that the bursts tend to follow quite well a model where they're proportional to the star formation. And that's a new result. One of the things that people predicted prior to the Swift launch, and then there's a fairly detailed work since Swift, is trying to guess how many Swift bursts are there, how many that we're already seeing out at high redshift. What are the chances that we'll be able to see out to a redshift of 10 or even 15 as the mission lasts for 10 years? And the assumption here is what I was just talking about, that they track star formation. The predictions range from about 7 to 10%. These are the plots that model in star formation history. And maybe about 0.5% for a redshift greater than 10. So over a couple of years, we see 100 a year, we might be able to get out to very high redshift. And there are probably bursts already lurking in our data set that were at high redshift and we didn't realize it. So because we've only gotten redshifts for about a quarter of the bursts, it's hard to do. So I did a little study to try to see if there are such bursts that that might be there in the data set that we haven't recognized as high redshift. So this start out, how can you tell if a burst is at high redshift? First of all, you wouldn't detect it in the optical. It would be a burst that you haven't observed in the infrared, because if we saw it in the infrared and not in the optical, we already would have gotten some estimate of the redshift just from the Lyman break. And systematically, maybe it was at higher duration, you know, longer bursts because of the cosmological time dilation. So, okay, this is a little background. This is what the duration distribution looks like for SWIFT for all the bursts, the long bursts and the short ones that we'll talk about tomorrow. And then these are the ones with redshifts. You know, the typical, people always talk about the typical number being about 30 seconds long. Although if you de-shift it and move it into the rest frame of the burst, this is what the distribution looks like. So the real intrinsic average duration of a burst is really more like 10 and not 30 seconds. You know, you can do this when you have enough bursts. Well, there's quite a spread, though. You know, the long bursts go from a few seconds or maybe a second up to still up to tens of seconds. So just looking at the duration, you know, doesn't seem like it'll be very promising for, it's not a unique, powerful tool for determining the redshift of a burst. And that's shown here. This is the duration. This is sort of, this is for the average. Versus redshift starts at 10 and then it goes to higher, of course, as you go to higher redshift. But this is the spread. The data points are actually shown here. You can see that, yes, if you see bursts that tend to be, you know, 50 seconds long or, you know, much longer than that, there's a hint that they would be at high redshift, but it's not definitive. So then on this plot, but it is a kind of hint that maybe they are at high redshift. Then I plotted on this plot those bursts with optical non-detection, no infrared observations, and what are their durations. So you can see they tend to be sort of high, long duration bursts. And there are six of these in the data set. We've seen two bursts at redshift greater than 5. Some fraction of these may be also at high redshift. You know, maybe half of them. It's hard to guess. It's not implausible that SWIFT has already seen, if we only knew it, already seen 5 or 7 or even 10 bursts at redshift greater than 5. Now I'm going to turn to cosmology studies with bursts. And this is a field in its infancy. But it's already quite interesting. This is the work done by Amati. That's done already prior to SWIFT, but there's new SWIFT data that's been added in. And it's the realization, or the he noticed, that if you look at the peak of the energy distribution in the prompt emission, so where does the spectrum peak in the new F nu, kind of where's the new peak in the new F nu spectrum, and plot it versus the energy of the burst. So these are bursts that have redshift. Now in this case, he used EISO, which is the isotropic energy emission from the burst going out in all directions, because that's easy to calculate. You know what the flux is, you know what the redshift is, so it's a simple calculation. And there does seem to be a correlation, the Amati relation. So this is neat, because that means you can use something from the burst that you can measure just from the gamma ray signal, which is E peak, and use it to calculate what the total energy of the event was, or the luminosity. So this would be a way to independently learn what the luminosity is, and then if you knew the redshift, you could, you know, make a Hubble diagram. But the spread isn't, you know, there's still a lot of spread in this data. Then it was realized by Girlanda and the Girlanda relation, that if you don't plot EISO, but you plot E gamma, that it's a much tighter correlation. So what is E gamma? E gamma is the amount of energy in the burst, taking into account the beaming that's going on. And how do we know how much beaming there is? That's why I have some backup charts I can show you. But basically, you look for changes in the temporal decay of the light curve for indications of beaming. As the light curve first starts falling, you're looking at the outflows are highly relativistic with Lorentz factors of 100, and so there's relativistic beaming, and you're seeing emission right along the axis coming to you from this material streaming out. But as time goes on, this ejecta, this jet, slows down, and so you end up with Lorentz factors more like 1 to 10. And at that case, there's much less relativistic beaming. You see more and more of the jet as time goes on. And eventually you get to the point where you've seen the whole jet, and at that point the idea is that the light curve changes in slope. So you look for these changes in slope, and for some of the bursts you can get estimates of E gamma. This is the plot of E gamma versus E peak, the Guirlande relationship, and it's a much tighter correlation. There's much less spread here. And so there's some good promise that you can use this to do cosmology. No, because you're trying to do this from measured parameters without taking into account knowing the redshift. So this is the measured E peak.
These are all redshift 1 probably, right?
Well, these are before SWIFT, so there isn't that much redshift distribution. I think I haven't actually seen that plot, it's a good question, but I think there would still be a good correlation. There isn't a systematic location. Oh, I know the answer to this. Yeah, he says.
The way the correlation is actually different.
Yeah. In the previous plot? I thought that this was E peak observed. Okay, so I don't know. It's a valuable question. Now, we've done some work on this with SWIFT and Japanese students that are working with SWIFT data. And actually, we find some cases where we don't agree with the Guirlande relationship. So these are three different bursts, and you can guess from the Guirlande plot when the jet break would have occurred. Now, that's another way of looking at this. So we know what the E peak is. We can measure what E gamma is. Or to get E gamma, you need to know when the jet break occurred. And we don't see a jet break at those times. And so the assumption is either the jet break was before or after. And these are the limits that you get. And so they kind of exclude the region of the Guirlande. It may not be disproving of the Guirlande relationship that we don't see these jet breaks. There are other ways with multiple injection of energy that you could mask a jet break and not really see it. But it's a kind of hint of trouble, I think. And already, Guirlande and colleagues have started to try to use the bursts using their relationship to then, do a Hubble diagram and calculate W naught and W prime and see what regions this includes or excludes compared to supernovae. You can see that with the current data for 100 bursts, you can't do that much. Although you can perhaps exclude some important regions of phase space that the type 1As leave open. Now, for your amusement, I grabbed some plots off of a press release that Brad Schaefer had.
Well, I thought we were never going to talk about this publicly.
I thought
you're being recorded.
I thought you'd enjoy this.
But
I'm not saying these are correct results, but they're quite interesting. So what Brad Schaefer has done is he's done not just the Guirlande relationship, where you calculate luminosity from E peak and Amati, but he's done a whole bunch of different ways of calculating what the luminosity is based on intrinsic characteristics of the burst. And each one of these has proponents and people that have been pushing them, lags, variability, rise time, number of peaks. And they each seem to have correlations, but none of them are extremely tight. The tightest one is the Gerlander relationship. But what Brad did is he takes each one of these and then weights them and add it all together, gets a tighter correlation. And so with that, he's able to make a gamma ray burst Hubble diagram and get constraints in the W prime W naught plot that are much tighter than what is done with Gerlander. And he had this press release at the AAS meeting that this excludes at the 2.7 sigma level a constant cosmological constant. So I think the feeling in the field is that this is quite interesting. This may be something that can be used in the future. It's really too early, perhaps, to make such a claim based on the current data. This is a really neat plot that Neil Tanver made. It shows the highest redshift object of observed in these different techniques for galaxies, quasars, and gamma ray bursts. You can see that we're really screaming up in bursts, and I don't know if the trend's going to continue, but if it does, we are headed for bursts at the redshift of 9 or 10. Certainly is a very nice plot. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about afterglows, and then we can open up for discussion. So one of the things that we've discovered with bursts is that a big conclusion is that the afterglow light curve isn't just a smooth function falling off, with some slope, perhaps with a jet break. They're a lot more rich in terms of spectral shapes, in terms of flaring. About half of the bursts have a very bright component right after the burst. This is something that there was a hint of it in the Beplo-Sachs data from a couple of bursts, but we really hadn't seen it very often. And now we're seeing it with beautiful clarity. And it's something that you need to look at within the first few hundred seconds to measure. So SWIFT is ideal for this. For almost every burst, we get this kind of sampling of the light curve out from 100 seconds out to many days. And then I'll show you a movie in a minute, which is really neat for a lot of bursts. But just to explain what we're looking at, this is a plot where you combine the BAT data and the XRT data into one plot to try to see what the light curve looked like from the prompt emission flowing into the afterglow. Well, how can you do this? The BAT's observing in the 15 to 150 keV range. The XRT is observing between 0.2 and 10, the different energy ranges. Well, the way you do it is you look at the spectrum from the BAT and the XRT combined, and you extrapolate the BAT down into the X-ray band. So this is the extrapolated X-ray flux. So, take it with a grain of salt. But this is our best guess of what the X-ray emission looked like during the burst. This is a logarithmic plot in time during the burst and then flowing into the afterglow. So let's see.
I'm sorry, you're just taking something like a band spectra then?
Yes.
You're going, okay.
Yes. And in some cases, just a power law. So this is about 40 bursts, and you can just look at them as they flow by. And one of the remarkable things is that in almost every case, the BAT connects very smoothly into the XRT early afterglow. And you can see there are a lot of different slopes, but there are quite a few that have an early fast decay. I'll let it run through a couple of times. And you can also see, go back to the beginning again, that there are quite a few that have these flares. It's about half of the time that you see flares. And it's about half of the time that you see this prompt early decay. This is really nice work that Paul O'Brien has done at the University of Leicester, looking at the data set from all of the SWIFT bursts.
Okay.
I showed you, I guess the first plot that I showed for the burst from yesterday really doesn't count as a flare. In that case, we're looking at the prompt emission. But these are some nice examples of what the flares look like. They tend to occur in the first hundreds of seconds. They can be very bright. This one actually had as much energy in the flare as the prompt burst itself. So, they can be important for the energetics of studying the burst. Most of them peter out after the first few hours. That one from the redshift 6.3 burst that lasted for days afterwards is quite remarkable. Although remember that that also needs to get redshifted back. And so it's not really that discordant with these near redshift bursts where we see the flares mostly going for hours. In the rest frame of that burst, it was also lasting more for hours than for days. This is a kind of generic shape that we see for a lot of bursts. It has the prompt phase. Then there's a very interesting flat phase. I'm going to show you a nice work that Yanni has done on trying to understand what that's all about. And then it breaks to a steeper, and sometimes there's evidence of a jet break to an even steeper slope. And then here's the flares that come in some cases. First of all, let's look at the prompt emission. This is what one of the ideas is. The basic conclusion that we're coming to is that this rapid falling off emission and also the flares is due to the prompt emission of the burst. That somehow coming from these internal shock interactions in the burst as compared to when this jet material starts interacting with the external shocks with the circumstellar material. And one thing that's been noticed is that there's a rapid decay falling off after the gamma ray burst in many of these cases. Also after the X-ray flares, there's a very rapid decay that occurs. And so this is consistent with the idea that this is due to curvature effects. That you're seeing, you know, on axis you're seeing the primary pulses, and then at a delayed time, because you're off axis, you're seeing the tail emission. And so the X-ray flares and also this bright emission, we believe, is due to basically the central engine and this primary outflow that occurs. Then here's this paper I was talking about from Yanni. It's very hard to understand this flat part. If you have a single jet, it tends to fall off quickly. And how do you make this flat phase? And we see this flat phase, actually maybe Yanni knows better than I do, but it's a pretty good fraction of the burst. And so what he postulates is that there's a narrow jet at the center and then a wider jet. This gives some of the parameters, and these combined jets allow you to understand this flat phase of the burst.
That's what I have.
So we can got a lot of other things we can show, but that's if we have questions, we can get into a discussion if you like. Thank you.
First of all, Neil, it's amazing. You, like your vision, you kept things through the dark there, Neil, in under 40 minutes. Questions. We have plenty of time for discussion.
There's one.
I'm not an expert. Can you explain this curvature effect a little bit?
Okay. Well, the idea is that you have these, you know, you have these shells going out, and when you're off axis, you're seeing a delay just by the light propagation time from being not on axis. And yet it's the same prompt shell that's coming out. And so the primary acceleration mechanism is seen delayed off axis. It's a basic description of it.
So one can think of it in these terms. Consider the emission is pretty well localized in the lapsing time and in radius, but it has some curvature. You can approximate the emitting shell as being here locally, the local radius of curvature. So the first photons to reach you are the ones along your line of sight, and then if you go to larger and larger angles, then you have a larger distance to travel for the photon. Basically, time delay. And that's why they reach the observer later times, and since they're not directed towards you, then the beaming of radiation towards the observer would be weaker. So that's why you have a rather sharp drop in flux. You see a very rapid decay.
But that also has a very steep spectral dependence, because you also don't enjoy the boost. So is that consistent? It's not only delayed in time, but less red blue shift.
Right, because it's off axis.
Yeah, so do you get both?
Well, this paper that Bing Zhang has shows that you can. He does take that into account.
You look at Paul O'Brien's sample, and this one, I'm not consistent because
it's not consistent.
Yeah. That's actually a very interesting thing. If you look at the Paul O'Brien full sample, this sort of hard, the thing that I presented as a hard conclusion really isn't that hard. There are lots of bursts that don't fall off that steeply. And there's actually almost a continuum of decay times. And so, I don't know if you have any comment about that, but there's quite a variety of different light curve shapes that are seen.
There are two tricky parts here. One is usually you assume the burst is the jet is perfectly uniform. It's perfectly spherical. Probably both of these assumptions are not very accurate in a more realistic model. Second thing is what you choose for your zero time of the power law decay. Basically, the earliest times are dominated by the latest peak or spike in the light curve, and you should choose time from the beginning that spike to its peak, roughly, and your zero time. So these are two tricky parts.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from that, by and large, it seems to be reasonably well.
Well, the time I can see, the e to the minus exponent is sensitive to T0, but the spectrum is not. It should be softer.
Yes, but usually you don't see a peak in the spectrum of decaying emission.
You're using the power law slope change.
Yeah, because I'm seeing this higher and higher altitude emission. I'm losing my Doppler boost, so.
So Neil, do you actually have, then you're saying for this tail that's falling off, I mean, you know, the count rate is probably high enough that you have a power law measurement of the.
Yes. There, in fact.
As a function of that, where you are on that decay.
In fact, all of the virtually all of the spectral results from the XRT are consistent with power law, and you see a softening as time goes on as a general characteristic of the spectral evolution of these. And I think that's also consistent with what you would see from this curvature effect.
So I'm just being lame right now. I'm trying to figure out are these numbers up for the white? Is the theta W the wide jet angle?
Yes, I think that this is the wide jet, and it's about 3 degrees, right?
Well, let's put it this way. It seems to be
the wide jet
relatively clear about what is the initial very steep decay seen in most bursts. It's probably the so-called tail emission, and what is the third part that is seen at relatively late times or in a few hours or longer that was seen before. So what is trickier is the intermediate flat part. And there are various different explanations for that. It's not obvious which one of them works. It could be that different effects are at work in different bursts. This is one possibility. You have two components, and this model was invoked several years ago for various motivations. And so on. There are other alternatives. It could be not the Indian handle. It could be a number of different things. Right here, you see a plot where you can fit this with the two component jet, but you can fit it almost as good with not the Indian handle and so on. So it's not unique.
Yeah, I'm happy with that. What's the relativistic factor for the wide jet?
Well, here it's the Lorentz factor of a few tenths, where the narrow jet is a few hundredths.
So could it be a cocoon? The cocoon part, when people drive the jet up, and this cocoon that's also.
That's one of the motivations. Yes. Another motivation would be neutron-rich ejecta driven magnetically, which decouples from the proton-rich component, and since it's decouples early on, it doesn't get as carbonated in form for a white jet. That's another motivation.
your model, you were looking down the axis of the jet, I guess, if I recall, for these.
Yes.
And so what would happen as you start going off axis with that kind of double jet, you know, two component model?
Well, in this kind of model, it is assumed that only the inner component has a high enough Lorentz factor to produce absorbed gamma rays. So if you're not within the narrow component or even close to its edge, you might miss the transmission.
Mm-hmm. I know there's been quite a bit of discussion about looking, you know, what these bursts would look like as you move off axis. And, you know, perhaps ones that are viewed far off axis would be these X-ray flashes, which tend to be more dominated than X-rays. I think that hasn't really worked out in detail.
Well, you have to be careful. With X-ray flashes, then the problem is that the definition is operational. They're not very physically motivated. So it could be that E-peak is rather low for a number of reasons. It could be a reasonably large redshift. It could be that intrinsically it's low. It could be that it's viewed off axis. It could be a number of things. So you have to treat it, you know, on a case basis. But at least in some cases, it seems that there is good evidence that it's because of an off axis viewing angle. It could be that in other cases, it's because of a different reason. But if you look at the most extreme cases of the lowest E peaks, I don't think there's any good evidence to the contrary. Yeah, you have to view.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Yeah, Les.
You said that the flares at 1,000 seconds, 425 seconds, that to you those are clear evidence of extended emission from the central engine. That mm-hmm. It's not environmental, if you will. But it's rather the central engine.
Yeah, that's the hypothesis.
Okay, so, I mean, I guess I'd like to understand, because here's a model where here's a model you're showing where this is not a central engine issue. This is environmental. And this was a model which did not have a central engine generating anything at 10 to the 4 seconds. So maybe good to trigger a discussion to get some input from different people.
Yeah, you could.
From the data, you know, what's one really going to say?
There's no data on this one.
I know, but I think I see where this is going. I mean, for the flares, you have to postulate that there's some other energy being pumped in, or there's other, you know, lower velocity shocks that are catching up. And so if you're going to do that, you know, you could explain this soft part by just some structure in the outflow to begin with. You know, I think that's where you were going with the question.
Well, I mean, you showed all the black birds, right? And a third of them have flares which are maybe as much as 10% of the
right.
My question is just, is that really, you know, by what mechanism does the community understand whether or not that's evidence that the central engine had that prolonged activity of 10 to the 4 seconds,
mm-hmm.
or that the central engine had, you know, 100 seconds and this is all just weather after the fact?
Structure and the material that it's running into or something like that.
Star, whatever.
Okay, so
the strongest evidence is the very sharp feature in time, that you have a sharp rise and decay over time scale, delta P, much smaller than T, the time from the prompt.
But okay, but if you look at the flares, a lot of them weren't that way.
But some of them are dramatic.
Some of them are.
Okay,
The ones that are not very sharp, it's not very clear that they have to be because of the
It's simple. It's an argument even you'll buy. Delta T by T is 8,000. They make it very sharp at late times. You have to come up with more and more, you know, cloudlets and all that.
But then my question is. So here's an example where I think what you're saying, Sri, is that this is central engine. You're saying the same,
yeah.
Right? Okay, fine. So I take that. But then for that one, I see an energy comparable to the peak energy. Okay. But there were a lot of flares that weren't this sharp, that were much less energetic. So my question is, there are some which, you know, if you went through your flash movie again, right?
Yeah.
There are some which were.
Yeah, this was the extreme.
Which were not as.
But if you go to that high redshift stuff, I think the factors of two variations at late times. The very first one being short.
You know, another arc.
That one, you'd say. Sorry, they're moving.
Yeah, it's
I'm trying to get a sense for what's the cut. You know, what's the.
We'll have to see it in the viewing, because this way it's set up doesn't allow to stop. There is another, you know, bit of evidence, or at least argument, that these have something to do with the prompt emission, and that almost all the flaring, except for that, you know, very high redshift burst that I showed you, occurs quite early on, you know, in the first few hundred seconds. Now you'd expect if this was some kind of structure in the medium or something like that, that in fact you would tend to see these as broader washed out bumps later on. You know.
Okay, I'm just trying to get a sense for what.
I guess, I mean, what Sri just commented on was like clumps that it's running into, but then there's also, can it be something in the jet that, you know, so the structure and the, can you also rule out, it happened in the engine at the same time, but there's different relativistic values, that's all ruled out as well?
Well, it's hard to get a very large amplitude feature, yeah, very sharp.
So the hard part is the,
yeah,
the large.
It's a delta F by F of order unity happening at 10 to the 4 seconds.
For this one, yeah.
But I think the high redshift bursts are more impressive because you see at later times, yeah, this is certainly impressive. But look at the first.
Like, let's see, I guess.
We started off with
this kind of thing.
That's a long scale. That's some pretty impressive players there.
Yeah. Now, this is the observer, as I pointed out, the observer frame. It would have been shifted back by a factor of 5 or 7 here. But
this is a factor of 10, yeah, so some of these are factor of 2 variations. That's pretty impressive. And look at this time scale. You can't be arguing this width divided by this time here. This delta T by T is well below you.
I have a question. How good is the spectral sampling of these flares compared to the underlying continuum? Is it clear that the spectrum is different?
Yeah, there's in that Nusik et al. Paper, there's some plots for the few cases that there is good enough statistics to make a spectrum. And it tends to, as the flare occurs, it tends to jump up to a harder spectrum and then evolve during the flare for those few cases that have enough photons towards softer. So I don't know if that's what you were asking, but that's...
If it's only a handful of cases, it isn't a very large...
Right. Like maybe 3, something like that.
So. Other questions? Yes?
Yeah, I'd like to understand the bias of the observations concerning the redshift distribution of gamma ray bursts. So I understand that it's much harder to detect the gamma ray burst at a redshift of 8 compared to 2 because of the time relation. Maybe.
Yes.
So is there a way from the current data, say, to reconstruct what the intrinsic redshift distribution of gamma ray bursts would look like? Maybe assuming they all are similar to, you know, the low redshift paths.
Mm-hmm.
Has this been tried? Or?
Well, okay, so I'll comment on that in a minute. In addition to the bias of being hard to detect these stretched out light curves in the gamma rays, it's also, you know, very hard to, from optical and infrared data, to measure and determine the redshift for a high redshift burst. And, you know, most of the bursts don't have enough sampling with big glass to really be able to say. And the hardest ones to see are the faint ones. You don't see in the optical, but you happen to have a great infrared Subaru or something like that, and saw it. So there could be many bursts hiding in the data set that are, you know, there is a bias against finding high redshift bursts because it's so hard to do.
But how strong are the constraints right now? Could it be that we have as many gamma ray bursts from redshifts higher than 5 than we have from redshifts lower than 5?
No. No, it couldn't be that many. Because you wouldn't expect those at Those ones at high redshift would not have optical emission. That would be cut off. And I showed you the sort of six that have that are the candidates for high redshift that we can't rule out as being at high redshift for other in other ways. And
it's
so
only the ones which were triggered, so maybe you missed a lot.
Oh, I see. This gets back to your first point.
Yes.
I see. But there are a lot of bursts that we're just not seeing, that we're not triggering on, because they're dilated, they're weak.
Just wondering how quantitative can one be at this time.
No, I think that's a good point.
Ooh, I thought that was the plot you showed a plot. If you take this gamma versus this redshift and run it up in redshift, and you show how it goes through your sensitivity to this plot.
Right. Yeah.
Well, then this answers partially, I think, that question, doesn't it?
Because this is
these are specialist
two particular birds.
Yeah. What I guess the point is, you know, there could be a whole bunch down here.
Yeah.
That you know, that we're just not seeing.
Look at the low redshift sampling and assume the high redshift ones look the same, and then which fraction would one see?
Okay. I was going to get to the modeling, you know, with the star formation rate, but that's not what you're asking. You're asking just observationally, if you take the time structure. You know, you could do this, you know, as a Monte Carlo kind of study, but, you know, a sample of bursts at low redshift and stretch them out and see which ones could be detected.
With the, it's too early to attempt it.
No? No, that's quite an interesting.
Well, you have the BATSE database. You would just use the BATSE data.
Yeah.
That's all you do. You just take the BATSE bursts and take each burst.
Put them through the trigger algorithm.
Assume they're low redshift. They're all low redshift, right? Assume they're low redshift, redshift one.
Mm-hmm.
Assume, and then just do exactly this exercise.
Yeah.
That's what you're asking.
Yeah.
That would be that you wouldn't want to use your data set. Probably want to use the BATSE data set.
Yeah. But you'd want to put it through the trigger algorithm of Swift, or you could even do it on a plot like this.
Right.
There's a first cut.
It's not something you might want to do, but could you change the algorithm to optimize the high redshift?
Well, we've tried to optimize for high redshift by having this image trigger. So, you know, I think that's the right way to do it. If they're time dilated and stretched out, that you don't worry about the rate trigger, but you're always looking at images of the sky and see if something new appears. I think that's the only way you could do it. And that's what we do. We have that. Well, that'd be a nice study you can do, or maybe we can talk.
Other questions?
Ken?
In the redshift metallicity diagraph, the metallicity could be contaminated by the work ray, like wind material could be already enhanced.
Mm-hmm.
If we see line feature just from the secondary material.
Right. Not just because it's in a cloud of star formation, but you're talking about from the progenitor itself.
Yeah, progenitor.
Yes.
Can we distinguish between circumstellar and microcloud absorption feature?
Well, based on two diagnostic differences for the UV spectrum, if you have high resolution, the surrounding, the pre-explosion nuclear event or whatever, that has high velocities, and the galactic would be different. Okay, so you would be able to see that in velocity space. Also, you know, I say if you see some neutral lines, they're most likely galactic rather than circumstellar. Again, you know, it's a complicated, because you can see there's so many things, I can't generalize an answer here, but probably for the refractory stuff like the zinc and chromium, it would be galactic and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have such low ionization potentials.
So carbon could be bad.
Yeah, carbon is a bad one. That's why I said zinc, chromium. I mean, which are anyway better, I think, for other reasons. Because carbon is always too much reprocessing by every possible star. Whereas the refractory stuff, their low ionization velocity will be different. So you really need high resolution to do this stuff. This is not, I mean, this is the best we could do that day, which is not the high resolution spectrum. But we did get a high resolution spectrum for the one last night, so.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. The redshift is 2.3, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, nice.
It's low redshift. Mm-hmm.
It's not interesting. 2.6 is coming from 59.
I don't remember this.
I don't either.
I mean, that constraint on the progenitor, this on that Chris was asking, you know, it's to do with this composition of the stuff around the exploding star in relation to the kinds of models you have.
Mm-hmm.
It's silicon and something else, and we see small amount, and therefore the low mass.
Silicon and carbon 4, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think the point there was that. The 40 that I was talking about yesterday is now consisting of 25 core. Actually, it's higher.
No, this is a free explosion. It's not, we don't know the Z
exactly.
At all.
Also, a question about this. You say less than 25 solar masses, but how should I see that? Is that 20 to 25, or can it be as low as 10? Because that makes quite a lot of difference. 25 solar mass cores.
It's an upper limit based on this relationship of the kind of silicon. The more silicon you see, more massive star comes from. It's not. That's. I don't think there's a lower limit on this number yet because we didn't see anything, so it can be zero.
But if 25 is the
number,
it could be 100.
Yeah, that's the point. That's why it's not a constraint. My point was it's not a big constraint because I don't think you get that many 100 solar mass stars anyway, so I don't think GRB is 100 solar mass.
Well, we're almost nothing explodes at 25. This is less, it should be much less, so it shouldn't.
Yeah, but I would think a CO4-5 solar mass is collapses, well, density forms is like.
So, yeah, I'm going to take the privilege of standing around here to get a couple of discussion things.
Yeah, I have a couple ideas too, but go ahead.
Yeah, one is two things. One is a very specific one, and then I want sort of take the collected wisdom here to see where to next, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the specific one is, and maybe it's a segue to the second question. The specific question is, in the Bebo-Sass days, you know, 50% were not identified, and we all said, well, if only we could get to it within 100 seconds, and if only we had a better X-ray detector and all that stuff. Well, you love that. You get to it quickly. You have a better X-ray detector. And the number still seems 50% unidentified, roughly speaking. Okay, not quickly, but it's 45 versus 55. You know what I'm saying? It's still a large fraction of the 100 bursts. We have 27 redshifts. Only half of them have some sort of line, you know, arcsec.
Optical line. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So my question is, you know, what's going? There's something missing here now.
So I think I know what it is.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, as we got to these more capable instrumentation that we have on Swift, we also have moved to fainter and higher redshift objects. And so the problem got harder at the same time, at almost the same rate as the capability. I think if we were seeing 100 per year with Swift of the same sort of brightness sample that HETI sees, for example, that we would be getting optical afterglow for almost every one of them.
Okay, so that sort of segues into
or not everyone. There's still
question.
Some really dark ones.
So the bigger question I have.
You can prove this by looking at all the ones that you had low redshift. Are you getting optical? I mean, do you do that? Do you look at the sample that are all?
Ah, well, that's a biased question because if you don't if you have the redshift, optical.
That's right. Yeah.
So you don't know. But you can assume that the ones we didn't get the redshift for have the same redshift distribution.
Yeah, you do.
But you don't know individually which one came from
high-low. Yeah, you have to believe one of these relations, I guess.
So that sort of brings me to the bigger question is, without even trying how terribly nasty, which is to say, well, the bias of this Swift sample is completely up in the air. I mean, So issues of what, oh yeah, there's metallicity versus GRBs, I think is, it's a theorist statement. I mean, theorist wishing statement, not a real thing. I mean, because my view is that nothing can be said about any of those sort of ideas that have been floating around about metallicity, types of hosts, dust, no dust, dust with and without extinction, and so on.
Actually, you know, one of the reasons I was so excited when I started seeing this is one of the best papers, I think, in this area, abusing everything you can. And this is the kind of quantitative work that finally gets, you know, I don't know if we can trust 25 or not, but you could start getting a handle on that, the basic parameters, and measuring metallicity.
Yeah, but when you're missing half the sample, I think the biases are incredibly large now. So I could look at this figure here and immediately say, oh yeah, actually metal bridge things make GRBs at any given redshift, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone can turn around and so I think there's absolutely no statement that can now be made on metallicity and GRB production. I know,
the issue here is that's a 4.2 redshift GRB. Is that metallicity, a high metallicity at four, a redshift of four?
That's what the whole point here.
Yeah,
this shows that like versus like.
It looks like at four, redshift four, you're forming GRBs with the matter that you have. That's what it looks like to me.
I'd like to get into a theoretical discussion of this too.
Sorry to go the other way, but I just want to understand really what this problem is. Because it's central to the discussion. The gray dots, that's...
These are from quasar studies, absorption lines that are stunned, you know, quasar shining through galaxies. And these big dots are from the, you know, six gamma rays.
But this is a shift of two, the average metallicity was 10 solar, and I think that's predicting that it's much higher.
Yes, I think this is very misleading for the metallicity discussion. And the damped Lyman alpha clouds are systems that have had very little star formation affected.
Mm-hmm.
And stars don't form in there. Stars form in galaxies. And even at a redshift of 3 to 4, most stars form in massive elliptical galaxies that tend to have a rather high metallicity. It's much higher than this. So I think it's really misleading to look at this.
Well, at least to interpret this as the metallicity history of the universe, which is, I think that's not what it's trying to...
But it's not doing that.
Yeah, that's
I agree
it's
with
It's only
you.
Tracing the gas.
Right.
The gas, but it's not the gas that has formed stars.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we know of ellipticals that are, you know, have ages, stellar ages, 10 to 11 gig years, which are twice solar.
Mm-hmm.
So you put them on the spot, redshift 3, they were zero.
Yes, I mean, in models for elliptical galaxies, the ones in clusters form mainly between redshifts of 3 and 4 and have metallicity of twice solar.
But it is actually this is important data, though. These are, and particularly I think the burst data points, because this is answering a different question, which is what is the metallicity of regions where massive stars are forming? You know, I think this is a good answer for that question.
There's little star formation in the Lyman alpha burst.
Well, but the bursts are, and so, you know, quite independent of what you see for the quasars here, the bursts really are coming from star formation regions. And so, you know, I think this is actually...
Sorry, I guess what the plot that you would want to compare this to is what Philip's asking.
Yeah,
is, you know, the metallicity at the place where, you know, 80% of stars are being formed at that redshift. And I think from what we see at later times in ellipticals, I think Philip should correct me, but my understanding is that if you plotted that, then at redshift 3, you know, most of the star-forming regions have a metallicity of order unity.
Yeah.
Okay. And what you're seeing in Diamond Alpha, of course, are places that are at low densities.
Okay,
but you're talking about...
this is a theoretical statement.
It's based on looking at elliptical galaxies.
So let's choose...
It's a phenomenological statement.
But I want to understand how you made this sample.
Yeah.
Because it's all about making samples in this game. So let's say you have some machine that selects redshift 3 galaxies in a certain redshift range. And then I make a histogram of my of these things. But only galaxies you can select at these sort of things is through emission studies, you know, through some sort of narrow band technique or otherwise. So they tend to select the bright galaxies.
No, I'm saying you do it the other way. I mean,
and the corrections those people do. I mean, including even less sophisticated thing. I'm not talking about metals. Even a crude indicator like the star formation history of the universe. The way Seidel and company go from that redshift measurements, the UV light they measure, to solar masses per year, has three steps in it, the product of which adds up to 12, or multiplies to 12.
Well, there are other techniques, and they're looking actually at the local properties of elliptical galaxies, yeah, and doing what they call RKO something.
And that's
what my statement was based on, and that gives you very early formation age.
But there is another point, though, Lars, and that's, I mean, these are, this you might say is the metallicity for clouds that are forming or regions that are forming, you know, very massive stars, and not necessarily typical stars.
But I mean, maybe the fair statement is that the Damplon and Alpha clouds, right? We know that that's not where most of the star formation is happening.
Yeah.
So I think that statement we can all agree to. Sure. So we already know that in terms of a mass-weighted metallicity, you would not use the Damplon and Alpha as your indicator. So in that sense, this is a bad comparison because the naive assumption is that the GRBs track the star formation rate, and therefore the mean metallicity should track the mean metallicity of star formation rate. And if you look at that sample, then you'd say, oh, that makes sense. Look at that. They're more metal rich in the places where there's no star forming. Surprise, surprise. They've got the metallicity of the average star forming region. You're done.
Yeah. But I want to forget all about GRBs. I'm asking a very simple question. Yeah. Choose a redshift range, if you wish, and tell me what fraction of stars are formed in what galaxies and what metallicity they have. Yeah, I don't care whether it includes ellipticals or not. I don't want sort of theoretical arguments about, you know, the fact you see some elliptical at redshift 1, yeah, fine. You know, that I'm just saying this is a very straightforward question. Right, that's what GRB is in this.
That's right. So I can measure, I mean, Philip mentioned that you can take elliptical galaxies.
No, I want
at redshift 0.
Yeah,
and you get an age and metallicity. And if you get an age and metallicity, we know how to get age as a function of redshift.
That's the best way you can do it.
Yeah,
but what's wrong with that?
You may not
because
be satisfied.
This is too much of a theoretical thing. I don't
know. Well, it's more reliable in this case.
Well, I mean, it certainly, I wouldn't want to use
GRB. The theoretical is the clock tips, right?
Actually, just ask a information on that. In the metallicity at 6.3 is somewhere slightly above minus 2, I think according to this value date.
Okay, that's a useful
point. 6.3,
yeah.
Around minus
2. 10 minus
2? Yeah.
So there's a point out here.
Yeah, but
not 2 is small.
Right. Well, that's an interesting. So that's from the Subaru?
Yeah, it's published.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, so Neil, I'd like to come back. Where do we go from here? I mean, I agree with you that while you've improved and brought in more things, it's just a real thing that things are harder now. But how does this feel? In terms of glass and things to follow, nothing is changing the next few years. So mm-hmm. I was wondering whether people had some ideas. How does one change for next year? So 27 redshift will have maybe 50 redshifts, I would say. And instead of 50 arc second IDs, hopefully we'll get 70 arc second IDs.
Yeah. Well, I think for the next year or two, there's certainly value in adding those kind of statistics. You get to a point where, you know, you have enough, or you know, you're not going to learn that much more over another.
Yeah, the part I'm worried really is the biases of what we're not seeing.
Right.
And the part I'm very skeptical of, perhaps compared to almost anyone in the room, is that the optical and submillimeter studies. The claim is they see all the star formation history there is, and the GRB galaxies are puny galaxies. I think that's an entirely circular statement. Because the only way you can prove that is you take a sample aperture, whatever it is, 2, 3, something, and you go between all the way from QL star to 10 to the minus QL star, and then you say, well, it really means something to be at L star. Namely, that's where pi L times L star, L is peaking, which means that the low luminosity tail is not divergent. I don't think these statements actually can be made. And the power of GRBs is we can actually, we can easily go to 10 to the minus 2 L star. So if this slope below L star is divergent, GRB is the way to go. If it's convergent, then the traditional VLT, VMOS, all that sort of, you know, get, that's the way to go.
So I think, yeah, I think the answer is, you know, what are the biases? Gamma ray bursts are a great tool. Swift is providing more of them. But the idea before launch, maybe, that everything is on board and you can, you know, you have everything you need, we're really no different than we were in the past, yeah, where everything's dependent on the ground capabilities.
Yes. Well, that's what I started by saying. I don't see big changes in the ground capabilities in the next year. So what should the strategy be?
Well, although I do see, I mean, I think people are doing better follow-ups in the last half a year than in the beginning of the mission, as you sort of see what kind of bursts there are and which ones to go putting big time on. I don't know if there's still a learning curve there.
Are you searching untriggered bursts in the neural data?
Yes, we are looking for those. We found one last week, which was a very long event. We thought it was actually a transient, but then it wasn't in the galactic plane. It turned out to be a burst.
Is this the one from 2 days?
Yes. Yeah. It was just 2 days ago. But So the two different kinds of untriggered bursts. There's just, we happen to see a rate increase, and so the burst could have been off anywhere in the sky. And we see some of those. We see about 2 of those every week. But those don't provide much information because you haven't imaged them. And so the more interesting thing is, were there some bursts that occurred in the field of view of the instrument that weren't triggered because of, you know, because the trigger wasn't good enough, but maybe could be picked up in some other way. And there have been very few of those, only about 3, including the one 2 days ago. And so what's the characteristic of that kind of burst? That kind of burst is so smooth or so, you know, stretched out that you you can't even detect it with this image trigger on board. And so the one that we saw 2 days ago, you know, lasted thousands of seconds and was very smooth. And at some point, it got bright enough to actually just be seen as a steady source by the instrument. And then when we went back and looked, we noticed that it wasn't there 5 minutes before, it wasn't there 5 minutes afterwards. Oh, this is a gamma ray burst. So there are some like that.
At this way, you might answer this question.
Yeah, are there some, is there sort of a group of them there that are so stretched out and long and faint that we're missing?
Yeah, but we probably see only the tip of this population. Probably a more reasonable way to do an estimate is by modeling. Whatever you do, it has to be model dependent. Unless you have an ideal instrument to detect everything up there. It's not dependent on the sound delay.
I mean, yeah. You're always going to have to, in terms of asking what the intrinsic rates are, you have to, you can't just use the observed bursts and extrapolate them. You can do much better by trying to say that they're proportional to the star formation rate or some other assumption, and then test that assumption against what we're seeing.
It looks like we have a very extensive discussion. Do you
Tomorrow, short bursts.